Hello everyone, welcome back. This is Chander in Palo Alto, and I'm very glad that Arne is back. Every time he's not on the show, you know, sometimes we have guest speakers or, you know, guests of honor, that I miss talking to them. So I'm glad he's back.
Well, let's not insult our guests. They're good guests, but glad to be back. And hello everyone, this is Arne from Oslo.
Yes, of course. That wasn't the point. The point was we want guests, but you know, we have a rhythm. I have to behave with guests. With you, I can, you know, push back more and laugh more.
That's, no, yeah. It's exhausting to attempt to be nice.
Well, it's more fun, let's say, to be with you on the podcast. So today we are going to talk about Snowflake, not like a, you know, snowflake from the ice, but the company that went public yesterday. And I can't believe the pop. It's unbelievable. But before I get into, you know, my views on the pop and the valuation, Arne, you want to tell us what the company does?
Yeah. So let's just say that this is a kind of a crazy week. So first of all, there was, you know, Oracle buying TikTok, which is about the dumbest thing I've ever heard. And then Snowflake IPOs, and it turns out to be that it becomes the largest software IPO ever. So this has been like a sleeper that suddenly came into full flower. And it's a big deal. Of course, it's a good company as well, but I think nobody expected this kind of thing. So anyway, back to your actual question, what are they? So, you know, you can call it multiple things, but I think the closest explanation I've heard is cloud data warehouse solution. So essentially, it's a cloud data platform. So you companies collect all their data, and then they manage and process that data on this platform. And ultimately, that collection of multiple sources of data is traditionally data warehousing. And this is a new flavor of that in the cloud. That's sort of my simple explanation of what Snowflake does.
You want to say something about Data Lake? I think they kind of pioneered or like made that term more popular.
Well, I think actually there's been multiple flavors of Data Lake. So essentially Data Lake is just, okay, you pile all your data into the same place. So traditionally, you know, you've had data in all kinds of computer systems, and those are sort of captured in smaller proportions of those, and then, you know, in the data warehouse, you collect them in one place, and as data has grown into more and more, you know, you have that feeling that the data sets become larger and larger, and ultimately, data lake is a very large collection of data, and it doesn't have to be structured essentially. And that's what a large pool of data that's not necessarily structured is a data lake. And you've had that going on, sort of the buzzword a few years ago was like big data. You had like Hadoop being like a way of a technology for that. So there's been multiple flavors of it. So I wouldn't say that, or at least my view is not that Snowflake invented it, but the problem with the data lake in itself is that, you know, you have all this this data, and in principle, data is really valuable, and if used right, you know, you can bring out that data. But data is also really hard, and if you have like lots and lots of data, it's unstructured and it's hard to manage. It's hard to get that value out and the insight into that data. So what Snowflake does is kind of taking that data lake and helping to structure the unstructured data and provide a tooling to make sense out of that data. That's kind of a way of looking at what Snowflake does.
Yeah, and I would add one thing to that. It's kind of so that the data lake architecture makes it cloud agnostic. So you could have some data in AWS, some GCP, some, you know, Microsoft Azure. So it could be in different clouds, but either it's the lake, but I think that's where Snowflake in stuff I read is unique or is doing that. The data is cloud agnostic. So they kind of create a middle layer in between all the clouds.
Yes, that's correct. So, I mean, you have these solutions in AWS. AWS has a solution called Redshift, which is a data cloud data warehouse solution. But that's only an AWS thing. Mm-hmm. And Azure has, you know, cloud-based SQL. I can't remember exactly the name of it. And Google Cloud has something called what was the name of it again? It's called BigQuery.
Yeah.
So all of these have like their own data warehouse and analytics types of services. What Snowflake does is it sort of builds on top of that. And you can have it processes on all those three cloud platforms. Mm-hmm. So you can essentially choose which platform you want to use, and you can start optimizing from, you know, where the storage is best and what the compute is best and this sort of thing. So you're not locked into one of the cloud platforms, and you can sort of optimize the use of it with Snowflake on top. Mm-hmm. And in that way, avoid vendor lock-in, although you can of course discuss whether you're locked into Snowflake then. but nevertheless, it has larger flexibility, I would say, and you can optimize, you know, on storage and processing and that sort of thing. And the final thing to say is also it's kind of a timely position to be in the market, because what you know, not only is data valuable, but it's also a big trend around, you know, new tools for analytics and machine learning and AI and so forth to build on top. There's a quick development on that front, and you know that builds on top of Snowflake again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what, like, why are they so unique? This is kind of, what are they doing that's better than others?
Well, part of what we talked about is unique. This fact that, you know, it uses cloud, but you're not stuck to one platform. You have
other companies are doing that too. It's not just them.
Yeah, and so I mean, you can say, is there one thing they do that nobody else does? No, I wouldn't really say so. It's just that they have a greater degree of flexibility around it. And I think they're also sort of more easy out of the box. So they're probably quicker to start using. And so the threshold for using Snowflake is lower than alternatives, and makes it more accessible to, say, smaller and medium-sized companies, rather than, you know, these types of solutions have been more accessible to large companies have had more time to integrate and build systems, right? So there's something about the accessibility of it that seems to resonate a lot with customers. But you know, the three main cloud platforms have similar solutions. Cloudera, which IPO'd, I guess, about a year ago, has similar things. And there's a company called Databricks that I'm not... Mm-hmm. as familiar with, that also has some sort of system like this. But I think, you know, I think there's this convenience, flexibility, and sort of set of tools that is kind of unique about them. And customers seem to love it and consume it in at large scale and more and more.
Yeah. So a lot of big companies are using them. So I know Apple uses them, Uber uses them. Maybe Square also, I forget. But it's, do you know, like, a specific example that somebody found an insight using this, which they couldn't find before. Because one of the things I read is a lot of the query-based systems, you're trying to solve a specific problem. So the models you're building or whatever you're doing, you're looking for, you know, solution to a problem. What Snowflake enables is just looking at the data and telling you, these are the correlations, like makes predictive, more predictive analytics. But, you know, this is just what I read. So I don't know how true that is, or it's just media.
But I think that's more generic thing, in that if you use queries, that's like a typical traditional, you know, database function, whether it's a SQL database or something else. This looking for patterns or correlations in more unstructured data is more sort of in the domain of machine learning, and as applied in multiple different systems and ways of doing that as well. And that's a trendy area of activity. And so I don't think that's unique to Snowflake. I think what's more unique to Snowflake is that it lowers the threshold of collecting that data and making it available for those sorts of analytics or machine learning systems, right? So it's just enabling you to manage or structure or make available those data in a convenient way. And that's what Snowflake brings to the table.
And
you are correct that large companies use it, but I think large companies would use something else if it's just that Snowflake is convenient. I think we're Snowflake, and they have a number of customers who spend more than $1 million on them a year. But I think also making very powerful data tools available to more the mid-market is probably where they're more uniquely competitive. So I know that at least a few of our portfolio companies use Snowflake. So these are, you know, startups. They're not like two person and a dog startups. They're, you know, you know, between the 20 and the 100 employee type of companies, with large data sets.
Yeah. So what I meant, like, they can do this finding correlation and, you know, patterns. Of course, others can do that, but apparently they do it better or faster or low latency, or there's something that makes them stand out.
More convenient.
And what's the, like, other thing I read is, the platform is scalable, like you said, small startups are using it and big companies are using it, so you can go up and down easily.
And there are software as a service companies, although they do cloud, they're sort of a software as a service overlay over the cloud platform, which is then Google or Azure or AWS.
Yeah, this is, if those of you don't know, these are Arne's favorite company. B2B SaaS is his sweet spot.
Exactly.
You want to talk about numbers? So, you know, they more than double their revenue this year, almost three times. But, like, sales and marketing is higher than revenue. But maybe share the numbers.
Yeah, so, I mean, we can look at, so they have... you know, published numbers for two full fiscal years, which they call 2019 and 2020, but 2020 ended on January 31st. So that's a little bit of an odd 2020. But 2019 numbers was revenue of almost $97 million. And then 2020 was $265 million. So essentially over the last fiscal year, it multiplied its revenue by 2.7, which is super high growth for something that's at a pretty high revenue base. Yeah. So growth rate is staggering. And if you look at the last 6 months, was sort of ended 31st of July for 2020. So year over year in 2019, that was $104 million to $242 million this year. So that's a 231x year over year for those quarters. So it's growing super fast for being a pretty large company. And this is obviously one of the big issues of this company, the growth rate at this scale. Now, it's a super unprofitable company. Yeah, so if you look at the fiscal year 2020, so the one that ended on in January, while it had $265 million of top line, it had a net loss of $349 million. So it lost more money than the revenue was, which you know is essentially bleeding money, right? And for the last six months, when it made top line was $242 million, it lost $171 million. So it lost less money than sort of the revenue. Losses are decreasing while revenue are growing. So there's sort of a path to profitability, but it is a company that still bleeds a lot of money. And the interesting part of that is that so where the money disappears or sort of where they're bleeding is essentially sales and marketing cost. I'm actually, when I looked at the numbers, I was surprised to see the sales and marketing cost being so high and R&D cost being relatively low. But then again, at least the sales and marketing efforts are being spent on growing fast, and it is growing fast. You can't really say that it's not money well spent, because while they're spending a lot of money on sales and marketing, the revenue is growing. And the other thing, which is probably the most impressive metric I saw in the S1, is that their net dollar retention is 158%. So say you have a customer spending $100 this year, the same customer on average will spend $158 next year. So it is truly worthwhile getting customers through the door here, because the revenue increases. And that's why it still does make sense to spend that much on sales and marketing for both growth and the future growth of the same customer base.
Yeah. If you're growing, nobody really cares about expenses. When I say nobody, it's, you know, the analyst community or investor community, because the expectation has been, if profitability will catch up.
Yeah, so if you look at two numbers are important here. One is the payback time on sales and marketing, 21 months. So it costs a lot to get a customer, and it takes close to 2 years before that customer becomes profitable. That's also a function of their gross margin is reasonably low for sales market, software as a service company. But then again, because the net revenue is so high, is that the customer becomes massively profitable in the future. And so this is a little bit of an odd one in that sense. It takes unusually long to be profitable, but it becomes unusually profitable after a time, assuming the world doesn't change massively from what it looks like now.
Yeah. So I saw their NPS, RNA is 71. Is there, like, in your experience, B2B SaaS, is there like a standard NPS that's expected? They're above, below? 71 is pretty good.
If you look at the market overall, 71 is an excellent score. Now, of course, NPS tends to be higher in some segments of the market and lower in others. So good software as a service companies tend to have a high NPS. So I would say this is high, but I've seen higher, but it's still great. If you compared it to the markets that tend to have terrible NPS is like consumer credit or cable companies. They are about the right. I mean, they're consumer credit companies that are in the negative range. Yeah. So, at an overall, this is absolutely excellent. As a software as a service company, it's great, but it's not unheard of, and there are others on par.
Yeah, that's what I wanted to ask in the peer group. So those of you who don't know what NPS is, it stands for Net Promoter Score. So that basically you ask your customers, would you recommend this product or company to your friends and relatives or other people? And then you basically ignore people in the middle and make a calculation based on people who score 9 and 10 and below 5. Or maybe below 6, something like that. Basically, you ignore the middle who don't do anything. It's you take the top one and subtract the lower one.
So it would be higher than your average SaaS company, I would say, but it is on par with
other B2B SaaS companies. Yeah.
Like.
Okay, I didn't hear you on it. You said like.
Sorry, and there's clearly a connection problem. Could you repeat it? Sorry.
Yeah, so we lost you. You said it's good, but not unheard of. Like, so I think we lost you at like.
Like other excellent SaaS companies. They're like top of the cream of the crop of SaaS companies have in this range, typically.
Okay. So there was a lot of hoopla around this specific IPO. There were two reasons just in the last week. One was Warren Buffett's company, Berkshire Hathaway, invested in the IPO, and then Salesforce. So the original pricing was like, I think 75 to 85, and then it went to like 100 to 110, and then it was priced at 120, and it opened at like more than double of that. I mean, it's insane. So why there is so much hoopla around this? Like the numbers are good, but you know, not like unheard of for any other B2B SaaS company.
Well, I think I'm not sure if I would. I mean, some numbers are not outstanding, but I would say that the combination of growth rate at this scale and net dollar retention is unique. But I think it's a very complex view as to why did it go this way. So I think the Berkshire Hathaway involvement created some FOMO around the company. Secondarily, I think there are just very few assets like this coming to market, and essentially nobody can find returns in the markets today. So everyone tries to dive in. And I think that creates that frenzy that we've seen. But I think it's a staggering story around this valuation. So the company raised money in February this year, from professional growth investors. And the company was valued at $12.4 billion. And then, you know, the initial pricing range was, as you said, 75 to 85 kroner, dollars per share, which would put it at like plus minus $20 billion at expected, right? So that's like more than 50% up in half a year. Then they raised it, which would, you know, to 100 to 110, which would be, you know, $24 to $27 billion, which essentially would more than double the price from February. And then they priced it at $30 billion or 120 per share. So that's like 2.5 times the money in 6 months. and then it pops on the first day. It trades up 166% on the first day, and it settles down up 111 percent at the end of days, which essentially means that the first day of trading it closes at $68 billion of market cap when it was you know, valued at 12 and a half in February. That is just crazy. And I when I checked it a little bit earlier, we're a little bit down today, but it's still, you know, $63 billion.
Yeah.
And so this is where, you know, there's a frenzy. And I think like, you know, the IPO price itself was high. And then obviously there's a lot of people who don't get access to the share in the IPO. And I think there are lots of people trading and just want to have access to this. So we'll see where it settles down. But I think this valuation of $63 billion, that is 157 times 12-month trailing revenues. 157. And if you look at the run rate of the company, it's 105 times the annual revenue run rate. So, you know, there has to be extreme growth in the future to grow into a valuation like this. And that's for a company that's bleeding money. Although, of course, now the company has about, you know, $4 billion. It raised $3.4 billion. It had about $800 million on the books. So it has like $4 billion. And at the bleeding rate of this, it will take 8 months to bleed out. And obviously, it's not going to do that. So, I mean, but just like more than 100 times revenue for a company that's bleeding. That is... you know, I think it's a really, really good and interesting company. I just can't explain the valuation of it.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I think it's crazy. With so much uncertainty, like, to grow, they may, you know, eventually, let's say growth continues and like they may grow into that valuation, but valuing it at you know, at this valuation at this time is crazy. But I thought the investor, VC, and all these other people are smart. Like, just because Buffett invested, everybody wants to get it. Like, use your mind.
but it's not the, I mean, it's not the VCs who are driving the frenzy. It's the VCs who will ultimately cash in. I mean, the VCs are locked in, obviously.
Yeah.
But if you look at for now, but if you look at so this is where it's kind of interesting to look at the story of the company. So this is a Silicon Valley company, right? And so the story of the company is that it was essentially founded in 2012. It was sort of incubated by a VC in the area, one that's been around, Sutter Hill Ventures. So it was sort of incubated by, you know, one of the partners, or actually the managing partner at Sutter Hill Ventures, with somebody who was like an industry expert. So this is 8 years ago, right? Yep. But it was incubated at the VC. So Sutter Hill Ventures was like the seed investor in the company. And they subscribed to shares at 17 cents per share. Mm-hmm. Now, these shares are now trading above $200, right? So that's a 1,000x for that VC. So even if the share price is correcting, they're going to make a lot of money on that, right?
Yeah.
And so that, I mean, obviously they also raised, I mean, they also funded the company at higher valuations. So this is not their average cost. But Sutter Hill Ventures owned 20% of the company at the IPO for investing $200 million. And that's a stake that's now worth, you know, or yesterday was worth $12 billion or something like that. So that's a 75x on $200 million. That's a pretty good investment. And even with adjustments, they're going to make a lot of money. So it's not them who's going to be. And even the later stage investors, so Sequoia came in at, you know, a year ago or something at $7 a share, right?
Wow.
So, and now it's trading at, you know, north of $200 million, right?
Yeah.
So you can't. I'm hard pressed to call any of these VCs dumb.
No, I mean, I meant they may be driving the frenzy, so they make more money. But investors in general, I think a lot of the rise, I thought the 75 to 85 was highly priced. But then the news came out of Buffett investing, and Buffett actually may not even know about this investment because, you know, his Ted and Todd, they can invest up to like $5 billion without asking for his approval or telling it. So
he might have read about it now.
Yeah. But I think
on paper, he made $800 million yesterday.
Yeah. Yeah. So we, or I think both you and I think the company, it seems like a good company, but the valuation is just crazy.
Yeah, but I think this, so the Berkshire Hathaway thing is kind of interesting, right? Because it's very atypical investment. You know, if you look at least the history of Berkshire Hathaway, it's, you know, value investor.
Yeah.
And this is a company that you know, bleeds money. So certainly not paying any dividends. And you know, Buffett has said, well, you know, been somewhat of a tech skeptic, although he's also a big investor in Apple and so forth. So, but Apple is
biggest.
Yeah. Shareholder. But I think there's a big difference between Apple and Snowflake, right? Apple, you know, you could put it in the value bucket, even if it's a tech company. Yeah. Making a early stage for Berkshire Hathaway, not early stage for a VC like me, but an early, you know, in a company that's high growth and non-profitable is unusual, right? And I think that raised eyebrows when they put in like $750 million or whatever it was at around the IPO. So I think that has helped sort of the phrase frenzy, because people say, well, this must be something out of the ordinary, right?
Yep. Yeah, but you see, so people stop thinking themselves. They just, oh, if he's doing it, it must be good. Like how many, we work in tech and I can't really get into, well, I haven't studied it as much and I haven't used the product, but you gotta get into detail to figure out how exactly they're better. And I'm sure all these people who are investing, they don't know as much detail into the data lake versus data warehouse or what we can talk about. But, you know, that's how the world works.
But I think, you know, what's driving it is more, you know, this FOMO, you know, looking at, you know, high level metrics, which I think is quite interesting in itself. And then the fact that, you know, there are sort of market dynamic forces driving it more, like, you know, there are, you know, lots of traders and private investors on Robinhood that, you know, just thirsts for this on, and just will buy it even on slim volumes. And, you know, you have more sort of algorithmic trading, whether that's index funds or other things that, you know, need to get in. So in a market where it's hard to get returns and people for pattern reasons have to have a stake at this asset, mm-hmm. and there's little available, will drive you know some price increase in early days, even if that's not driven by fundamentals.
Yeah. So what do you know about their CEO, Frank Slootman or Slotman?
So I don't know much about him, to be honest. I know that I know not enough about him to have an opinion.
Okay, so what I know or read was he took ServiceNow public, which is now multi-billion-dollar company, and Snowflake was kind of struggling, so he was brought in I think 2-3 years ago to basically get them ready to go public, and I think his background is sales.
Yeah.
That's all I know. And he's kind of like, people know him in the enterprise software world. He's known person in Silicon Valley.
Yeah, but I mean, this is the normal way to do it when you go public in particularly in the US. Mm-hmm. It's you want to have somebody's hands on the steering wheel who's done it before. The appetite for a risky CEO at IPO in the US is very, very low.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what do you think? You know, I think we talked about it in one of the episodes, cloud in future will become a lot about AI. How do you see them performing then? And what do you think of their dependency on the cloud providers? Like, they work on top of existing cloud infrastructure. If they increase their, rent, then they will have to be, Snowflake will have to charge more money.
Yeah, so I mean, that's two questions, right? So yeah. One question, I think the whole machine learning and AI wave that I think will be, a push for years and years to come. I think it's highly aligned with that, because essentially machine learning and AI has to have data to work. And this just helps set up the pipelines of data in a better way. So I mean, of course, there could be some other way of doing that in the future, but I think it's following the mega trend. And if they, keep staying with the way of doing it and don't fall behind from a tech perspective, I think it's tailwind for them. I think the other one is a much harder one, right? Because I think there it's a distinct advantage that they do what they do, right? Because they're not locked into one of them. I think the customers like that. They feel that, still Snowflake is a smallish company. They won't screw customers, right? And so you have flexibility. You don't have a lock-in to AWS or Azure or GCP. I think there's a lot of things that's great from that perspective. And I think that's customer friendly until Snowflake, turns monopolist on the customers. And I don't see that they can do that because there is still competition. That said, it's a little bit of an uncomfortable situation because they are to some extent at the mercy of these three cloud vendors. And these three cloud vendors are also competitors with their own tools, right? Mm-hmm. So they're in a way a little bit less exposed, because in principle if one starts screwing them, they can port customers to the two other ones and so forth. But at the same time, AWS might say, well, we can build tooling that makes our cloud better, and then you're in competition, right? And then they can get a larger market share, for example. So that it's an uncomfortable situation where you're sort of a partner, sort of a dependent, sort of a competitor. And if those cloud vendors turn nasty, it could be a bad situation to be in. But then again, these guys are also, under scrutiny from competitive authorities, or competition authorities. So, this is something I would say is somewhat of a risk, but it's hard to say how big that is.
Yeah, it's definitely a risk worth not it being, whatever, $80 billion company now. What is their current market cap?
It was $63 billion a few hours ago.
$60 billion company. Just this risk is big risk. It may be low probability, but the risk is really high. Like, there's so much dependency on the cloud providers. But
yeah. I'm looking at it's like 63 now. One thing I failed to mention when you asked about this CEO, who I haven't really studied and haven't found to be, you know, all that particularly interesting. But, you know, given that this is Valid Nordic and we always want to have like a Nordic angle to this, mm-hmm. it's worthwhile noting that the CMO is Swedish. So Denise Persson is her name. So there is a Nordic angle to this company as well.
Oh, wow. You see, that's the reason they are so popular. It's the marketing.
It's the marketing.
Yeah.
Although I'm not sure the name and the branding, you know, in some ways it signals that it's something very lightweight, right? And mm-hmm. that might be good for the user experience. However, when you become a $60 billion company, you want to have that flavor of solidity and sustainability, right? And Snowflake might not signal that exactly.
Well, they're lightweight in revenue still, so. or operating income.
Yeah.
Yeah. Good. Any final thoughts before we end?
No particular additional thoughts on it. I thought this was it looks like a very interesting ride and definitely an IPO that was interesting to follow.
Yeah, we'll, you know, keep track and get back to it in 6 months. The lockup period for VCs, employees, everybody is generally 6 months after the IPO date. So it'll be interesting to see what happens then when a lot of people have the ability to sell their shares.
Yeah, and as a matter of fact, you know, the reason why Berkshire Hathaway invested, you know, $700-800 million was actually half a billion was actually secondaries. So somebody was selling. I think mm-hmm. I thought it was the CEO, but maybe it was the former CEO.
Hmm. Yeah.
that sold 4 million shares.
Wow.
I mean, that person lost $500 million on paper yesterday.
Yeah. Wow. Well, one day I will understand how markets work.
Wow. And it also puts petrol to the fire or gas to the fire about the ability of bankers to price something and the money lost in pops on IPO and direct listings and all that fun stuff we discussed before.
Yeah, I mean, I can bet money. Whoever priced it is not getting fired. He or she is getting a bonus. Like, imagine being wrong by 2x. But...
Yeah, essentially, that asset was mispriced by $30 billion. Great work. Yeah. Here's your bonus.
I got to get into banking. You can do all the wrong things and still make a lot of money.
Yeah.
Yeah. But somebody has to build new stuff. So I'm happy doing it. Okay.
Absolutely.
Arne, I'm glad you're back. You see, I had more laughs in this episode.
Yeah, is fun stuff.
Yeah, so thanks everybody for joining us. We'll see you next week.
See you then. Bye-bye.
Bye.